This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Will the downward spiral end? Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Independence Day. Glad you're with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
Civil discourse is in decline in the U.S. Is there something that can reverse the momentum?
The terrifying new stats regarding America's opioid epidemic.
On this July 4th holiday, a list of the states that have the most and least independence.
And the obsession over Snapchat streaks.
The way this works is that you have two people who start sending snaps to one another, and snaps count as either photos or videos. It cannot be just a regular chat, text-type message.
Catherine Bindley at the Wall Street Journal on the lengths that some people go to in order to keep alive their snap streaks. She's here later in the hour. Well, politeness, decorum, respect all seem to be endangered ideas when it comes to politics these days. The consequences of this trend are real and visible every day in Washington and in state capitals. Wall Street Journal executive Washington editor Jerry Sibes says anybody who isn't troubled isn't really paying attention. Jerry, how so?
Well, I think the biggest eyebrow raiser came in Montana when a Republican congressional candidate body slammed a reporter because he didn't like the questioning he was getting, and then was charged with assault and won the election anyway. And so I think that is a pretty good sign of where civil discourse or uncivil discourse, at least in the political realm, has gotten in the country. But you know, that's not the only example. Social media, go on social media and look at the way people talk to and about each other, and it's sometimes literal threats that are made there, and you get a sense of how far this has spread. And you know, the Democratic Party has responded to some extent in kind, and you have town hall meetings being disrupted, and the state party chairman in California using obscenities both to refer to his own party's protesters and the president at a meeting recently of the state party there. So there are all kinds of examples, but I think the sort of the general decline of conversation and debate in the country has been building for a while, and I think the Trump campaign kicked it into high gear, and that's where we are.
All right, so before we get to the Trump war there, how much, I always point to the anonymity of the internet too, where you could just create some account and just start lobbing bombs, and there's no punishment at all.
Well, I think that's part of it, but I'm not sure that it stops there, because you have a lot of people, you get email and social media threats from anonymous people, and you know, that's a phenomenon. But you have you have some things happening now that are not cloaked in anonymity. You had almost a fist fight on the floor of the state Texas state legislature over the weekend because of a dispute about legislation on sanctuary cities and calling immigration agents out to try to arrest protesters, and charges of violence being or threats of violence at least being bandied about. And so this has moved into a different realm, I think, to some extent. So some people are going right at it, and not with the cloak of anonymity that social media provides, but just head on.
So are you saying the president of the United States could change the course of discourse?
He could certainly help. I think you have to say that he shoulders some of the blame for this, a good part of the blame for this, because of the nature of the campaign that he ran last year. He made insulting his opponents, lying Ted Cruz and crooked Hillary, is kind of a regular feature, and he attacked the press in the most derogatory terms at his rallies. That got his crowd stirred up, and they sort of regularly threatened reporters who were there, and basically the campaign got pretty ugly, and everybody kind of knows that. And I think that was a he picked up on a trend that I think has been underway for a couple of years, but he certainly accelerated it, and now I think it's spread further. So if you if you want to know who can reverse it, I mean, certainly I think the president has, any president has the ability to affect the climate in which national conversations take place, and that's true here, but so other leaders have the ability to do it as well, and I think some of them probably need to step forward and assert that.
Like who would that be?
Well, you know, if you think about leaders of Congress, you know, who have the ability to say, let's just stop this here, and maybe modeling a different kind of behavior by actually having meaningful conversations with each other about important issues, that would be a good thing. And there's just too little of that right now. But also, I think kind of encouraging people in their own parties to, you know, keep debate in civilized channels and not be intimidated by the shouting that's going on around them. I think that, you know, that's probably not happening very much either.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal Washington executive editor Jerry Seib. His piece is called Civil Discourse in Decline. Where does it end? All right, so we've certainly identified all the problems here. I think we all agree on that. What's the solution?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I know, but I know somebody who's thought about this an awful lot is Father John Jenkins, who's the president of Notre Dame, and who spoke about it a bit at their commencement, you know, who's discussed this. And I called him up and asked him that question, what do we do about this? And he said the first thing is for everybody to recognize that this is a problem and that things have deteriorated and we can't just become accustomed to it. And then the second thing is that leaders have to be leaders. You know, you have to have some people who rise above this, as he said, and step forward and show us a different way and call people out for this kind of behavior. And that's, you know, I think that's probably where it starts. The anger out there is, in the country on both sides, is pretty real. The polarization is very intense, and the Trump phenomenon has made both of those things more acute. But I think that it turns around by people in leadership positions kind of leading the way out of this. Otherwise, I think we descend further, and these signs of violence that you're seeing, it's sad to say, they could proliferate.
Thanks, Jerry. It's Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib. 13 minutes after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Happy birthday, America. The opioid epidemic that has ravaged life expectancy among economically stressed white Americans is taking a rising toll among blacks, Hispanics, and Native Americans, driving up the overall rate of premature death among Americans in the prime of their lives. Since the beginning of this decade, death rates have risen among people in their prime in virtually every racial and ethnic group and almost all states, according to new analysis by the Washington Post. Here's staff writer Joel Achenbach. Joel, what have you found?
Okay, I'm going to throw some numbers at you, and I know that statistics make people's brains fog up, but this is an important number, is that in the age group 25 to 44, so, you know, young adults, you know, into early middle age, maybe, you know, but, you know, the prime of their lives, in that age group, since 2010, the death rate has gone up. It's gone up 8%. It had been going down because historically that's what happens. There's better medicine. There's, you know, the better medical treatment. People aren't supposed to die when they're 30 years old or 35 years old. But we have seen, starting around 2010, a reversal for that whole age cohort. So what does that mean? I mean, what is that telling us? Why are people dying at the age of you know, 25, 30, 35, 40? The shortest answer, it's not a complete answer, is it's opioids and drugs, mixtures of fentanyl getting into the cocaine drugs that are going into inner cities. I mean, what we see is this phenomenon of the opioid crisis, which has killed lots of people in mostly sort of predominantly white communities, working class communities, the Rust Belt, West Virginia, Kentucky, you know, coal country, that this crisis is now coast to coast. It's almost everywhere. There's no boundary by any one demographic group. I mean, it's not like something that happens to people somewhere else. I mean, yeah, this happens in every community.
Yeah. Well, as one person said in your story, it is out of control.
Oh, totally. I mean, this has been building for 20 years, really since the introduction of OxyContin and some other opioid painkillers, which some people need those drugs. I mean, when we write these stories, people write to us and say, hey, you know, without these painkillers, I could not live my life. My life would be unbearable. Mm-hmm. So some people need them. The problem is you go in for knee surgery, you go in for back surgery, or you know, you break your arm, whatever. Mm-hmm. Suddenly your doctor, you know, gives you a prescription, and you know, you refill the prescription. Next thing you know, you need these things, and you start getting them, on the black market from friends. And some people wind up addicted to heroin, or they just stick with the pills, and they can be highly addictive. And I think the addictive nature of them was underestimated in for a long time. More recently, people understand that. But then comes heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil, these other drugs that are washing across the country. So this is a crisis.
Jeez. We're speaking with Joel Achenbach, staff writer at The Washington Post. He mostly covers science, and he's written a piece entitled "The Drug Crisis is Now Pushing Up Death Rates for Almost All Groups of Americans." All right, so you say, too, the rash of deaths is a statistical echo of the 80s and early 90s when this combo of crack cocaine and HIV epidemics took a heavy toll. So is this, I don't know, another one, I hate to, for lack of a better word, another one of those phases?
Well, so if you, we're talking specifically about a relatively young group, 25 to 44. I want to say childbearing age, although that's not exactly the right term. Relatively young adults. That back in the 80s, because of HIV and because of the spread of crack cocaine and all the overdoses associated with that, you did see an uptick in the death rates then. That's unusual, because typically the death rates for all groups have gone down. So life expectancy goes up, death rates go down. That's the norm. That's what you want. That's the result of technology and better medicine and new ways to intervene with diseases. So what we're seeing now is since 2010, the death rates have gone up for whites, blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans. The only group that didn't have a statistically significant rise was Asian Americans. And this is an important point, because so much of the media coverage has focused on whites and the opioid epidemic among whites. It's important for people to understand that there's no sharp boundary there. I mean, this is happening across the country.
Incredible story. Joel Achenbach, staff writer at The Washington Post. It's 22 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Glad you're with us on this July 4th. Happy Independence Day. As summer kicks into full gear, so does vacation time. And guess who else is watching the calendar? Thieves and crooks and con artists this July. Here's how to avoid them from This Morning's Jennifer Koshenka.
It's summer, which means it's scam time. Whether you're home or traveling, there are a few things you should be aware of. Consumer advocate Christopher Elliott joins us now with some tips. Christopher, how can you get scammed when making home improvements?
There are so many ways. I've been scammed myself. One of the worst home improvement scams is the guy who shows up and gives you an estimate, and then he runs off with the money after you've paid him a non-refundable deposit. And that actually happened to me on a fence repair that I was doing a couple of years back, where I paid the guy and then he was gone. He actually skipped town and left and took my money with him. So there's so many different variations of this out there, but you want to be dealing with a reputable contractor when you're ordering your work. And a lot of people just go with the lowest bidder, which sometimes is a huge mistake.
So should you get recommendations from friends and family?
Absolutely. With a contractor, you want to ask around, ask friends and family if they've dealt with someone that they like. There are also several different online resources that you can use, Angie's List, places like that. Finally, when you do meet that person and they give you a bid, ask them for a list of references of people that they've worked with. And all those things can protect you. It's not a guarantee, but it can protect you from having shoddy work, or worse yet, no work done on your home.
Now, Chris, of course, a lot of people move in the summer. A lot of homes are closed on during the summer months. What are some of the issues with moving companies?
Moving companies are regulated at the federal level, and you can go to the DOT website and find out which ones are legit and which ones are not legit. But a lot of times you have a situation where they'll give you a low bid to move. They'll pack up all your things. And then when you move into your home, they'll tell you that you owe a balance and they will not release the furniture until and the other goods that you have until you pay that balance. And it's a little bit like taking your personal belongings hostage. And I've actually dealt with several cases like that where, and it's just really, really difficult with these unscrupulous movers to really get anything. They want your money.
Do you have any recourse in a situation like that? Do you have to end up suing them in small claims court or something like that?
Yeah, that's one possibility. You know, the other one is that you can complain to regulators. Again, they're regulated at the state level and at the federal level, too, especially if they're doing interstate transactions, so if they're going across state lines. And those are, you know, really important things to know. But, you know, you don't have to go to court. A lot of times, a little pressure on social media or even a politely worded letter of complaint or inquiry is enough to get the moving company to do the right thing.
We're speaking with consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. Chris, what about travel clubs? Are they worth it?
No, absolutely not. In fact, the only travel club that I know of that's worth joining is AAA. And it doesn't really function like the travel clubs that I cover on my website. That's Elliott.org. You know, the travel clubs, they're so funny. They incorporate in states where regulations are loose, and they will go to set up a shop in a mini mall and do these high-pressure presentations, tell you that you can save thousands of dollars off your next vacation if you just join now. The memberships are often outrageous. We're talking about thousands, even tens of thousands of dollars for an annual membership, and they are absolutely worthless. And I hear from people all the time who say, they've sat through one of these presentations. It sounds good. What do you think? I tell them, don't walk away. Run.
This morning's Jennifer Koshenka with consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. Like us on Facebook or send us an email. This Morning at CompassMediaNetworks.com.
Thanks for being with us. Happy July 4, Independence Day. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, the obsession with keeping alive Snapchat streaks, preparing for a future of automation and artificial intelligence, and the states with the most and least independence. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, if you've got a Snapchat account or have kids in the house who do, you're aware of Snapchat streaks, where you maintain a relationship with someone for as many days in a row as possible. Wall Street Journal news editor Catherine Bindley says some Snapchatters go to extreme lengths to keep their daily message streaks from disappearing. One miss, and you have to start again. Catherine, what's up here?
Okay, so the way this works is that you have two people who start sending snaps to one another, and snaps count as either photos or videos. It cannot be just a regular chat text-type message. And within these messages, these photos and videos, users will often add different lenses, as Snapchat calls them, which might, you know, make a photo of you look like a dog or like a cat, or they have all kinds of funny filter-like things that people will put on their snaps. And when you send one to a friend and they send one back to you within 24 hours, that's sort of the first day. of what would ultimately become a streak, assuming you can keep it going for 3 days. Once you've hit 3 days, you get a flame emoji next to the chat thread that you're in with your friend, and then it keeps count. And as long as each of you exchange messages once within 24 hours, then your streak will stay alive.
I can always tell when my son is in the middle of some streak he's trying to keep alive, because he takes a selfie that includes like the quarter of his forehead and then just like the wall behind him. It's just some meaningless picture, right, that just counts as keeping the streak alive.
Yes, there will be. I spoke with Snapchat users who said that they do this every single day of their lives, and they're often doing them with multiple people. So, one young girl I interviewed had 15 different streaks going at once. So oftentimes they will just send a picture of the floor, their shoes, the sky, and sometimes they'll just write streak across it so that whoever the recipient is knows, like, hey, I'm just sending this to keep our streak alive.
We're speaking with Catherine Bindley, news editor at the Wall Street Journal, about her piece entitled "Whatever You Do, Don't Let Your Snap Streak Die Tonight," talking about this feature and somewhat addictive one that the Snapchat has. How about the couple you found that had the streak going and then they lost it for some reason? They actually contacted Snapchat support desk and they gave them like a one-time courtesy?
That's correct. So what's funny about the two of them is that they were together when they noticed that their streak had expired, and one would assume that, you don't need to text or snap someone who you've been with the whole day, but you actually have to do that if you want to keep your streak alive. So they'd gotten to Samantha's house and looked down, and she was like, oh my God, our snap streak is gone. And he checked his phone and saw that the streak was gone. And she said they were initially kind of joking about it, saying, she was like, oh, Snapchat support is probably for people with real problems. And then her boyfriend said, well, what if we actually email them? And they did. And Snapchat, would not disclose to us how they determine whose streaks get restored. But Samantha, the young woman featured in the story, did send me, proof of the email from Snapchat that they had granted them this one-time courtesy and gave them their streak back. And so now it's still going strong somewhere at, it's at 300-something days now. So they've been snapping one another every day for over a year, minus the one day when they forgot.
Thanks, Catherine. Wall Street Journal news editor Catherine Bindley. That's got to get an asterisk, right? You agree with me on that one? You contact Snapchat and say, I need in golf, a mulligan? It's 22 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for spending time with us on America's birthday. Get ready for the machines. All generations need to be prepared for a future of automation and artificial intelligence, but should also know how to function without an app for everything. So says tech analyst Rob Enderle. Rob, what have you looked at?
Well, so I was at Dell EMC World, and one of the panels they had was put on by a futurist out of the Institute of the Future. Interesting organization, by the way. And they were talking about, the coming changes with regard to robotics, autonomous machines, artificial intelligence, and the rest. And on the panel, they had a futurist, they had a CEO, and they had a woman that ran a company that was focused, if she was a millennial and was focused on the ideas and concepts that millennials have, what kind of drives them in the market. And the differences between the groups, between the futurist, the CEO, the millennial, were pretty amazing.
I was surprised because in your piece you said the millennial on that panel was not really much of a subscriber that artificial intelligence will be a big player or will disrupt things, right?
Yeah, and not unusual. When we've had big waves, big technology waves and changes, the people that live in the present generally don't see them coming. And you would think the kids would get it, but she really didn't. And neither did the CEO, who runs a technology company. Hmm. The futurist did describe the kinds of very disruptive activities that are going to happen when a lot of the people we speak to won't be people anymore. They'll be computers, and we won't be able to tell the difference when we're no longer able to, no longer driving our cars, when the trucks and stuff around us are all driven by computers, and where much of our interaction isn't with people, but with computers, And certainly he thought that was going to be a lot more disruptive. Well, neither of the others thought, because they've got experience with computers as they have existed, certainly not as they will exist. They kind of thought, well, these are, you know, these are like the voice response machines or the robocall machines we talk to today, and they really can't do much. But that's not the way that they're going to be doing tomorrow. Within 10 years, you won't, really won't be able to tell the difference between whether you're on a phone with a person or a computer. And the computer will typically be better informed and much more strongly connected to real data.
Wow. We're speaking with Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm, the Enderle Group, and he's written a piece entitled Why We Must Prepare for the Rise of the Machines. You said, too, with ubiquitous information, the need to memorize and retain information will be massively reduced. Well, boy, what does all that mean?
Well, so remember, what we're moving towards is a level of integration between people and machines. So that's the end goal. If we move off into the 2050s, which is when the folks think the singularity is going to occur, when we'll be able to separate people from machines, that's the end goal of the path that we're currently on. And so our ability to pull information from systems means that no point, as long as we're connected, at no point will we need to memorize anything, really, because it's all going to be available to us on some service, in some web form, on some portable device that we have on us. On the other hand, our ability to delineate between what's real and fake gets much more difficult, because we live on this information, and so that information becomes corrupted, as we've certainly seen in this last news cycle with fake news coming in and apparently having an impact on the election, that we can be much more easily manipulated because we can't tell the difference. And so good news is we don't have to memorize a lot. Bad news is we can be much more easily fooled, corrupted, and harmed by information that we receive that we think is real but is not.
Thanks, Rob. That's tech analyst Rob Enderle, founder and CEO of the Enderle Group. It's 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Glad you're with us. In the wake of the 2017 National Senior Games held recently in Birmingham, Alabama, noted marathon runner Catherine Switzer wants to prove that by having an optimistic outlook on aging, anything is possible. She was the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon 50 years ago and wants to prove that at age 70, seniors want to grow, not fade. Catherine, what's the message?
The more you do, the more you can do is the message. And we really want people to realize the importance of staying fit their entire lives. That if they stay fit all their lives, they can live not only longer, but more healthily, happily, and optimistically. In other words, it's a better life. And it's better for health. It's better for the health of the nation as well.
That was a great line. What'd you say? The more you do, the more you can do?
Yeah, I made it up.
That.
You like it?
I love it. Tell me, here's what I ask of people who run marathons. You've run, what, 39 of them?
40, because I ran the Boston Marathon again after 50 years since I first ran it. Isn't that amazing?
Yes. So I want to ask, what's wrong with people like you who run marathons so often?
We're crazy people. What can I tell you? We love the distance and everything else. But what I really want to say, this is not really about running marathons. This is about people getting out and putting one foot in front of the other, taking control of their own fitness and their own health, whether that is getting off the sofa for the first time in 50 years or recovering from a knee replacement where they really have to learn to take the first step again, or maybe making a comeback after chemotherapy. Those are also elements of fitness that are very, very important and give people a sense of optimism when they can finally again have a sense of accomplishment.
Mm. We're speaking with Catherine Switzer, the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon in 1967. She's encouraging seniors to lead a healthy lifestyle. You got to revisit that day for me in 1967. You're the first woman to run the Boston Marathon. Did you get threats or anything like that? Like, what was that like that day or the days leading up to it or even a couple of days after?
I was the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon. Women had actually run marathons for a number of years before I ran, but not officially, and didn't get much recognition. Oh. Even in Boston, a woman ran and jumped out of the bushes and ran the year before I did. but I trained hard, and my coach insisted that I sign up for the race. He said, it's a serious race. You don't just jump into these things.
Yeah.
So he said, follow the rules, and I signed up. But I signed my name KB Switzer. This is not to defraud them in any way, but they obviously thought I was a man.
Yeah.
They issued me an official bib number. My coach picked up the team numbers at the local high school. I wasn't there to prove anything. I was there as a reward from my coach, who I proved in practice that I could run the race. So that was a breakthrough moment when the official attacked me at mile and a half in the race, tried to rip off my bib number and throw me out.
Really?
It was a terrible incident at the time. Widely photographed, and it became one of Time Life's 100 photos that changed the world, because it showed the enormous amount of discrimination against not only women in sports, women in general.
Yeah.
And what I'm finding now, 50 years later, when I ran the Boston Marathon, people were wildly excited, not only about the progress we had made in women's running, which is nothing less than a social revolution, but about the whole aspect of aging well.
Thanks, Catherine. Catherine Switzer, noted marathon runner. 7 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Glad you're with us. Happy Independence Day. What does it mean for whole populations to be independent in the modern sense of the world? In a new report, WalletHub's data team addressed that question by comparing all 50 states based on five sources of dependency: consumer finances, the government, the job market, international trade, and personal vices. Overall, the number one most independent state in the country, Colorado, with a total score of a little more than 69. The number two most independent state on the list, Utah. Number three, Minnesota. New Hampshire came in number four. It was Wisconsin at number five. Number six on the list was Massachusetts, followed by California, New Jersey at number eight, Virginia at number nine, and New York was number 10. The bottom three, meaning the least independent states in America, number 48, Alaska, number 49, Kentucky, and number 50, Louisiana. Happy Independence Day. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.